Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, near the 42nd anniversary of the return of our Vietnam POWs, we'll hear the story of former POW and retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger, who spent more than 6 years in the infamous Hanoi Hilton prison camp. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
There are few people that have a firm understanding of the freedoms that we have more than those prisoners of war who have lost their freedoms fighting for ours. For as long as I can remember, one of our military's most important mottos is, leave no one behind. The Department of Defense has created a new agency to help bring POWs and MIAs all the way home. As of January of this year, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency was established by the Department of Defense to more effectively increase the number of missing personnel accounted for from past conflicts, and to ensure timely and accurate information is communicated to their families. This agency brings together the former Defense Prisoner of War Missing Personnel Office, the Joint Prisoner of War Missing in Action Accounting Command, and the Life Sciences Equipment Laboratory. Consolidating the department's personnel accounting assets will lead to a better oversight of family resources and services, research and operations. The agency will enable the workforce to achieve the fullest possible accounting for our missing personnel, better anticipate family needs, and adapt to changes in the DOD and the United States government. The agency will also honor our veterans' sacrifices and confirm an obligation made to those serving our country. For more information on this new tool in bringing our service members home and leaving no one behind, visit dpaa.mil.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to minnesotamilitaryradio.com. Former POW and United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger, a retired officer who spent more than 6 years in the infamous Hanoi Hilton prison camp, will share his life-changing experiences and the lessons it taught him. He will focus on how he and his fellow POWs worked together to survive their years of incarceration. In this story of survival, bravery, integrity, and patriotism, he will share how the POW experience helped him assess what is truly important in life. Joining me now is former POW and retired Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger. Colonel, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Colonel, can you tell us a little bit about your military career? When did you decide to go into the Air Force?
I joined the ROTC program at the University of North Carolina. And when I graduated, I went to Big Spring Air Force Base and to pilot training. And I was in Class 64G, graduating in the spring of 1964, and was assigned to fighters. It turned out to be the F-4 fighter. I'd always wanted to fly the F-104, which looks real good-looking, sleek jet fighter, but then the Phantom came along and it was even faster and more impressive. So I ended up in the right place.
So like a lot of pilots, you wanted that one that was going to go fastest?
I came from the South. Every time we got in a car, we opened it up before we got out. And that's the way I flew fighters.
Get her up in the air and let her rip.
Let her rip.
So, sir, where did you do your training then on the F-4?
I did my training in the F-4 in a variety of different places. Training. I will tell you this about flying fighters, and I'm sure it's not as bad as it was because the digital age has made fighter pilots a lot more deadly without having to know a lot. The plane flies itself, in other words, nowadays. But in my day, it took 2 years of hard training before you were ready to go into combat. Nowadays, I've been told with fighters like the F-22 Raptor, that thing is so sophisticated that you can be very deadly in maybe 2 hours.
My goodness.
Things are getting a lot more efficient.
So it took a little more to fly that F-4 back then.
Oh, it did, and it took a lot more to fly, P-51 Mustangs and P-47 Thunderbolts and all that stuff back in my brother's day.
I imagine it did, sir. So when were you first introduced to Vietnam?
Well, I went into Vietnam in the 1965 time frame with the 43rd TAC Fighter Squadron. We were deployed to Cam Ranh Bay, which is a deep water port in South Vietnam. Now, of course, it belongs to North Vietnam. And the Navy came in and put down PSP runway, which is nothing but a steel mat. And we were flying missions off of that PSP with 8 500-pound bombs on the F-4. And as you ran down the runway, it's like being on a trampoline. You were literally bouncing up and down as you went.
And what year was that, sir?
That was 1965. And I left there about, 8 or 9 months later, went back to the United States, upgraded to the front seat of the F-4 as a first lieutenant, and then deployed again to Ubon, Thailand, to fly with the 497th TAC Fighter Squadron flying all-night missions along the coast of North Vietnam, interdicting truck traffic, boats, and so forth.
So that was that special series of missions.
Was a special mission because you were flying at night under flare light. So you had two aircrafts. One had was loaded with flares. The other was loaded with rockets or other ordnance. And you would drop a flare, and you better not get below the flare because then you could be seen. And there was a lot of ACAC down there along that coast, 37-millimeter, 57-millimeter. And so you wanted to be above it, and you'd look down to try and spot trucks going south down what they called Highway 1. And these trucks were always covered with limbs and trees and whatnot to look like a big bush. But you got pretty skilled at figuring out what was a bush and what wasn't.
Now, how many of those missions did you fly, sir?
I flew about 75 missions before I was shot down. You had one chance out of four of being shot down in North Vietnam if you flew missions in the North. 25% of the time you were going down.
That's pretty high probability.
Yeah, that's
sir.
Not real good.
So what day was the fatal day when you were shot down?
23rd January 1967, I was flying with four aircraft. I was number four, and I had finally won the opportunity to fly a daylight mission and chase MiGs, which is every fighter pilot's dream, is to have an engagement with MiGs. And the North Vietnamese had MiG-21s, MiG-17s, all provided by the Soviets. And the mission I was on was called Bolo 2. We had previously flown Bolo 1, which was a brainchild of General Robin Olds, who is now deceased. What he did was every day the F-105s, the Thunder Chiefs, would fly what we call the daily milk run into Hanoi and bomb bridges, fuel depots, rail sidings, and so forth. And they'd come through every day about the same time, and they would enter North Vietnam down what is called Thud Ridge, which was a long piece of small mountainous terrain. It ran right into Hanoi. So what we did is we adopted the F-105 call signs, and we loaded ourselves with missiles rather than bombs, and we came down Thud Ridge the same way. And so all the MiGs scrambled to intercept us, which is what they'd been doing with the 105s, thinking we were bomb-laden 105s, when in fact we were F-4s armed to the teeth with air-to-air missiles, heat-seeking and radar.
So it was a deception to get after them.
It was a deception. And when the smoke cleared that day, we'd shot down seven MiG-21s, and the rest of them had flown into China to get away. So we were on Bolo 2 because we waited a month and figured they would have forgotten. We were trying it all over again. But the day that I went in, we were carrying a QRC-160 pod. It had just been delivered, and we were the first to use it. That particular pod jams the guidance signal of the SA-2 radar system. And so we were all briefed on what to do. And one of the things they told us was that the pod does not light up and work properly. Fly up next to your element leader, and his pod will jam for both of you. So I was number four, and my element leader was number three, and my pod did not work. So I slipped real close to him, supposedly, so his pod would jam for the two of us. And by the way, about 7 years later when I got home, the scientist briefed us, if your pod does not work, do not fly up next to your element leader because you will double the reflected energy and be shot down, duh. How you like that? If you can't take a joke, you shouldn't fly. So there you are. But that's what I was doing. I was on Bolo 2.
And your instructions and your intelligence and how it worked were flawed, weren't they?
I'd be able to take a joke. The smart people don't always get it right.
So, sir, before that mission, how much training did the pilots get about what to do if they were shot down?
Well, we've all been to various survival schools. I went to a major survival school at Stead Air Force Base and also jungle survival and so forth. Unfortunately, I think the Vietnam War ushered in a new era because if you were shot down in Vietnam, one thing you were not going to do is walk through the jungles. That's not possible. You've got to walk on trails. If you walk on trails, it's only a matter of time before you're going to be captured or shot. So three things happen when you're shot down nowadays. You're going to be picked up right away, hopefully, or you're going to be dead, or you're going to be captured. And so we should have spent a lot more time not worrying about too much survival, but a lot more about how to deal with a POW environment.
We're speaking with the former POW and retired Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger on Minnesota Military Radio. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. Now back to our interview with former POW and retired Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger. So, sir, on that day, 23 January 1967, a little flawed advice, and what happened? Did you get shot down?
We were flying along at about 20,000 feet, and we were about 4,000 feet above a deck of clouds. In an SA-2 missile environment, you only have seconds to react if something comes out of that cloud. So we should have had at least 7,000 or 8,000 feet. And as we're flying along, and I'm tucked up against my element leader because my pod's not working, I had a Ross scope. The Ross scope shows me every electronic signal that hits my aircraft. And as long as you're trained to know what the signals mean, you can have a lot of useful intelligence. And the first thing I realized, since my pod wasn't working, that we had two different SA-2 sites looking at me with an acquisition radar. I was waiting to see the guidance signal on the SA-2, because that's what really counts. But I also could see that I could tell that one of the sites was at my left 10 o'clock position, one it was at my left 8. So I was watching those real carefully, and all of a sudden I see a missile coming up underneath us at left 10 o'clock. I called that out to the flight. I said, "Shark flight, break left, SAMS, 10 o'clock low." Everybody began to turn gently in what is called pod formation, assuming the pods are all working correctly. Mine wasn't. I became nervous after a while. That first missile that came up had a fireball on its tail. If the missile's got a fireball, it's not yet guiding. The fireball has to extinguish. That's when it goes into guidance phase. And I could tell that the first missile wasn't going to be a problem, but I was getting very concerned about the second missile because I couldn't see behind me. And so at a point, I said, enough of this, and I flipped upside down and pulled as hard as I could because I just did not like the feeling. What I did not know, later I found out my backseater said, when you flipped upside down, there was a big missile about 20 feet long coming into the back seat with me. As you flipped upside down, it went off. It blew the right wing off, half the left wing, and all of the tail. They reported me back in my backseater as missing in action that day, probably killed in action. We were very much alive in a chunk of that aircraft. And when the missile hit, I saw something that I had never seen. In an F-4 Phantom, you have a lot of warning lights, like your hydraulic pressure is low and so forth. Well, every light in the airplane came on at the same time. It says you need oil, you're overheating on your right engine, you're on fire, and there was a caution light came up I'd never seen that said, you're in deep kimchi.
Which means there wasn't much of the plane left.
But anyway, I'm sitting there kind of fascinated with all these lights. My backseater thinks I'm dead. He ejects. I never heard him go. I'm just, I guess, traumatized by all the fireballs around me and all the mess that's going on. But finally, I decide I better get out of this thing. So I reached down to pull the handles, couldn't get hold of the handles. And I made a major effort to reach down. I grabbed the handles, pulled the handle. I went out of the aircraft, and I knew it was going to be breezy because we were running about 700 miles an hour true airspeed at 20-some thousand feet. And after the missile hit, I imagine we slowed down quite a bit. We may have been running 500 miles an hour for all I know. I don't know what it would have been. But I shut my eyes very tightly, pulled the handle, and I was right. It was very breezy. And when I opened my eyes, I'm blind. I can't see. So I instinctively grabbed at my face and discovered, to my great joy, that my helmet had spun around on my head and I was looking in the back of my helmet.
Good explanation for not being able to see, sir.
But then what I did, I'm sitting in the seat, and there's a drogue chute stabilizing the seat, and the seat's going through the cloud banks, and every 4,000 or 5,000 feet is a bank of clouds. And every time you go into a bank of clouds, you can't see. It's that thick. And I'm going whoop, 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 through these banks of clouds, waiting for my automatic release from the seat to kick me out and deploy my parachute. And there is a sensor on the side of the seat, a barometric sensor. And at 10,000 barometric altitude, it's supposed to activate. And I'm sitting there going through these cloud decks saying to myself, I wonder if that sensor is going to work. And then I said, well, wait a minute. Why don't we do some calculating here? So I knew I'd gone out at 20,000 feet. My brain's running like a hyper supercomputer. So I decided to manually deploy my parachute. So I pulled a handle separated from the seat. I was stabilized at 80 miles an hour going through these clouds. Now I'm falling 125 to 130 miles an hour. It looked like a Laurel and Hardy movie going down through these clouds, limbs frailing and whatnot. And when I pulled away from the seat, my parachute flies up over my head about 10 feet. And I grab a cord that's attached to it with my right hand. And I'm falling on my back with a cord in my right hand thinking, where's the daggone handle for that thing? And I pull the bag down. There's no handle on the bag. And then I realized the handle was right on my shoulder strap the whole time, and you're not supposed to pull the dang thing. When it's right there in front of your face, it'll break your back. But I did. I went, and I went, yung! I said, it's been a rough day. And then I landed amongst 200 soldiers with everything from rifles to pitchforks.
And what kind of shape were you in, sir?
Well, I went out very healthy. I had a pretty good laceration, and I had some other injuries. But I wasn't nearly as badly injured as, say, a John McCain who had two broken arms, a broken leg, a broken shoulder, and a bandaged foot.
So you landed on the ground safely and immediately surrounded by...
I literally land in the prison, practically. All they got to do is open the gate.
They thought, here's a gift from the sky.
This was a really good day for them.
Oh, my goodness. Now it was the start of your incarceration in the camps.
Indeed. Indeed.
And how was that first day? Had to be a real shock to your system.
Well, it is a shock to the system, because as you went into the system, particularly once you got there in the 67 time frame, it was nothing but constant torture for everybody who walked in the door. Everybody. 100%. And you went immediately to the torture chambers. And they didn't waste any time. They immediately started asking you questions like, what's the name of your squadron commander and other things that you should not be given out and are not required by the Geneva Conventions to say anything other than name, rank, service number, date of birth, etc. They immediately brought in their torturers and began the torture program, and that would last anywhere from a day to about a week, depending on how much you could take.
So, sir, if I might ask, what was your first introduction to torture?
They had a variety of techniques, but the major methodology that they used was something we call the straps. They would put manacles on your wrist behind your back. Now, a manacle doesn't have a chain. It's rigid. And Vietnamese manacles fit Vietnamese wrist. American wrists are probably, 30% bigger, typically. So it was difficult to get those manacles on our wrists, and there's a set screw that they screw in to tighten them up. And in the process, they would sometimes tighten them up enough to break a bone. So those all by themselves were like hell cuffs or tight cuffs. But once they got those manacles on your wrist, then they took about a 20-foot nylon strap, and they started at the wrist, and they would lace it around your wrist up to your elbow, all the way up till they pulled all of the tendons out of your shoulders. Extraordinarily painful. And, of course, with that, everything constricted like that, you immediately, your fists would grow up, look like boxing gloves. And at a point in time, gangrene would result. And that was the typical torture. They had others, but that was the major one.
The first day in camp, they introduced you to all the bad things.
Yes, and then they played games. And, you depended on... One thing, they didn't waste any time when I got there. Torture was immediate. They didn't talk to you for 2 days. They asked you, what's your squadron commander's name? You said no. They brought in the torture and started the straps.
Sir, I heard you speaking, and you were talking about several different methodologies that the North Vietnamese went through in different years. They had some years where it was one type of punishment, and then they changed their program, and then they changed it again. You experienced most of that from that point until the end of the war. Can you share with us just a little bit what was North Vietnam doing? It didn't sound like they knew exactly what they should be doing or how to do it.
No, they weren't skilled in trying to extract intelligence from us, and they were just very brutal. But the type of treatment you received depended on the year. Initially, 100% of us were going through the torture chambers. That was from about 1965 up to about probably 1969. That was the real brutal torture period. After that, they still tortured, but it was a bit more selective. Just to illustrate their lack of skill in developing intelligence, they brought in some Cubans, and the Cubans were going to teach the North Vietnamese camp authority how to torture how to extract intelligence without torturing Americans. And after about a year and a half of trying to make this accomplish this, the Cubans had to resort to torture to get anything, and they lost face and left.
So they were going to teach them how to do it, and it didn't work.
And then they adopted
the North Vietnamese.
Just didn't work. But the brutal period ended about 69-70, and after that, it was a lot of abuse and some torture, but not nearly as much.
So it was clear that the North Vietnamese weren't obeying all of the rules of the Geneva Convention.
Good grief. Nobody's ever going to obey the rules. I mean, if you think you are, you need some help with some maybe surgery or something.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back with more of our interview with Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger in just a moment. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been speaking with former POW and United States Air Force retired Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger, and we'll get back to that interview in a moment. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly message from the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelledo.
More than 500,000 Americans have been captured and interned as prisoners of war since the American Revolution. Prisoners of war have bravely endured the loss of the very freedoms they fought to defend at the hands of their captors. We take time to remember and pay respect to the POWs who, through circumstances of war beyond their control, have been held captive by enemy forces. They have endured one of the greatest challenges one can face, the loss of personal freedom. Let us vow to never forget the sacrifices POWs and their families have made for our freedom. Their efforts and sacrifices help build the strong foundation we have today, which continues to drive us forward.
Thank you, Commissioner Chalutoff. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Now back to our interview with former POW and retired Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger. Sir, one of the other things that I heard you talk about, communication and leadership, was big in, for all of the POWs. And one of the things that I read about in the book called POW was the TAP code. And the enormous efforts and time you put into communicating with each other and being a group, where the North Vietnamese tried to separate you and isolate you, and that really didn't work, did it?
No, they didn't have much success at all at stopping our communication techniques. But the TAP code, for those who are not familiar with it, we took the alphabet, we threw out one letter, because there's 26 letters in the alphabet. We wanted five rows and five columns, so we had to throw away a letter. So we interchangeably used the letters C and K. And so that allowed us to tap up and down. The first tap was the row. So if you wanted to do a B, you'd go one tap, that's first row, and then one, two, that's B. If you want to do an A, it's first row, first column. So
you just spell out the words one letter at a time.
Yeah, right. You tap one letter at a time. Now, the neat thing about tap code is you could communicate through concrete and anything that carry a sound. And so it was useful in that regard. However, we called the TAP code analog communications, very archaic. We had more sophisticated methods of communicating later. One of them was airmail delivery, and the other was hand code. We call that digital communications. The airmail system was we would write a note, creating our own ink and our own pens because we had nothing, and we'd write a note. And then we had tools that would allow us to drill holes through the soft concrete and brick that surrounded the courtyards of our compounds. And we could pull a plug out that we had after we drilled a hole. And we could cough and send certain signals by coughing and spitting and whatnot to the other side, maybe 50 feet away to another compound. And they would pull their plugs out. And everybody would clear the area so we would know nobody's to the left or right and whatnot. And then we'd give a cough signal and we'd take that note and we'd throw it. Airmail delivery over to the next, into the next compound, and they would throw them back. And so as long as you had a clearance system, you could sit there and exchange airmail delivery all you wanted. Now, one day, the guy that did our throwing for us screwed up and threw short. So we threw him over the wall and made him go get the note.
I'll bet he didn't throw short again.
He didn't take too much time to get over here and back.
Well, one of the things that I heard you say was communication, laughter, and prayer.
You're absolutely right. If you can't laugh, you're in trouble. And prayer was constant and powerful.
And so through that communication and through the help of and the leadership, you were able to pull together. And I heard you say also this morning that 100% of the POWs failed, or 100% were successful in not cooperating with the North Vietnamese.
That's right. We were tortured at 100%. The Vietnamese camp authority and the government was quite surprised that we would all choose the torture chamber rather than to provide them any cooperation. And so that's why they instituted later all of those programs that they created to try and break our will to resist.
Colonel, one of the stories you told were about two Navy flyers that did speak. And could you share that with us?
Talking about Nels Tanner and Ross Terry.
Yes, sir. These
gentlemen were asked to write a letter claiming that we were bombing North Vietnam, or they were bombing North Vietnam, which was a lie. Bombing the city and the dams and dikes and various civilian targets, which was not true. And so they refused to cooperate. So they were brutally tortured until they wrote this letter claiming that they had been ordered by the highest authority in America, President, Secretary of Defense, to bomb the city of Hanoi, which was a lie. And after repeated torture sessions, this naval flight crew wrote this so-called confession. The North Vietnamese proudly packaged that confession, and they sent it to the Bertrand Russell's War Crimes Tribunal. they read this confession aloud at a public hearing. In the back of the room were United States reporters, and the confession read like this. It is true. Nels and I were ordered by the highest authority in America to bomb the city of Hanoi. We were told to concentrate our bombs on old men, women, children, churches, pagodas. And the mission was so important, we were given as a flight leader Superman. And we had Batman on the right wing and Robin in the slot. And all you young folks don't know who Robin is, I'm sure.
How'd the reporters buy that, sir?
Oh, they rolled out of their chairs howling with laughter, wrote their press releases something to the effect of, our men are really pulling one over on the North Vietnamese communists. Now, once Hanoi figured out what happened, they grabbed Nels, they grabbed Ross, they took them to the torture chamber, and there they languished for the next 2 years of their life in agony, in retribution. But the good news is those brave American heroes came home on their feet, and they did all the rest of us an everlasting service by burning badly Hanoi's propaganda extraction machine.
So then they learned they had to be pretty careful about what they were going to get and how to use it.
Oh, yeah, and they never did quite learn that.
Colonel, one of the other things that I wanted to ask you was, while you were there and while you could hear the bombing, you knew that the war was still going on and that we were fighting. And I imagine among all the other things that you're worried about, one of the things you were considering was, when are they going to come and get us or let us go home, and concerned about abandonment.
Well, the abandonment part was primarily impacting those individuals who were married and had children and who received letters. We started receiving some letters. It took about 4 years before anybody knew you were even there. But then eventually we started receiving some letters, and the camp authority read these letters over the camp radio system. And those letters read pretty much the same. Dear Benjamin, it has been 5 long years, and the girls and I still do not know if you're even alive. And I've had to make some horrible decisions because we must go on with our lives. I have obtained a divorce. May God forgive me. Now, we had certain individuals who were receiving those letters up there who were married, had children, and you can appreciate why, under those kinds of conditions, some of those men felt terribly alone and abandoned. In my case, I didn't have family, and so I didn't have the pressures of a wife and children. But my concern was that I might contract a contagious disease and either become crippled or die before I could make it home. This was an unhealthy environment in which to live. We had Americans dying of typhoid fever and interrogators dying of malaria. You needed to leave.
So you were hoping that you'd stay well enough and alive long enough to be able to come
home. Yeah, because once you get to typhoid fever, you're not in good shape.
Sir, you indicated that along about 1970, when Ho Chi Minh died, things changed a little bit.
Dramatically. Absolutely. Ho was the cross that America's Vietnam prisoners of war had to bear. But when he died, the government of North Vietnam was provided on a silver platter the opportunity to change policy. And they did. It was dramatic. But let me add some perspective by asking three questions. Was it ever in accordance with the Geneva Conventions? No. Did we ever see the Red Cross? No. Did we have Americans going legally blind for a lack of simple vitamins? Yes.
And, sir, at some point, the bombing stopped, and you must have known that something was going on. And that was probably the point where you were really concerned about, Lord, don't let me get sick now. This is just about coming to an end.
Yes. And then the days turned into months, into years, and the bombing had not started back. And that's when we, because we'd always privately agreed amongst ourselves that the bombardment would never stop without an agreement to release the American prisoners. And then they did stop for a prolonged period of time. The camp authority reminded us every day we had been deserted. But then Dick Nixon sent in the B-52s. And I will never forget the day I was communicating with a building up on the northeast corner of North Vietnam. It was about not quite 100 yards from where I was. And we were using our fingers as hand code, signaling from one compound to the other. And it was on a hillside, so I could see his hand sticking up in the compound 100 yards away. And he could see mine from the window where I was. And we were communicating just as fast as lightning with our hand code. And with the kind of eyes that pilots have, we all had about at least 20/20. I had 20/10. You could actually see those fingers, you know, down there. So having good eyes did help a lot. But I was communicating that day, and he sends me a message that says, today, guard says, two B-52s shot down over Hanoi. And I held my hand up, which meant stop. And I turned to the kid that was helping me receive the communications, and I said, if I got that right, there were two B-52s shot down over Hanoi yesterday. I said, do you know what that means? He says, what? I said, it means the war is going to end. He said, well, why do you say that? I said, Dick Nixon would not send in the B-52s without every intention of sending in the 82nd Airborne behind it, if that's what it needs, in my opinion. Within a week, we were moving back down to Hanoi by truck. And very quickly thereafter, the war came to a conclusion. And then we did have an Air Force major walk into our compound in Wallo, an emissary for the military, to explain how the release program would go with our senior leaders, and we were all in attendance.
This is Minnesota Military Radio. We'll be back with more with our interview with former POW Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger in just a moment. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. Now back to our interview with former POW and retired United States Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger.
The first release was the sick and wounded. We negotiated that people would go out sick and wounded first and then in order of shoot down. In other words, someone shot late doesn't get to go out first.
Sure.
Well, the second wave that was to go out, the Vietnamese played a trick, and they picked the people they wanted to go out second instead of order of shoot down, which is what they had agreed to.
Did that work, sir?
Well, it created quite an incident. The man who was supposed to go on the second release refused to go. Well, when the word got back to Henry Kissinger that they were ready to release another 200 Americans and they wouldn't come home, he about had a cow. Says, you got to be kidding me. And they said, nope, they won't come home, sir, except an order released. Well, this held up things for, I don't know, a little over a week, I think. And they sent another emissary in it that read us the riot act. And finally, we negotiated a settlement with our senior leaders that says, okay, you get one time, we'll go out of order. You do it again, we ain't coming. I love that.
So that kind of ended years of not following orders.
Yeah, so we went out of order that one aircraft, and after that, we went in order.
It was a pattern with that you showed the North Vietnamese all throughout. It's, American POWs didn't follow orders very well, did they?
That's about right.
I think it's an important point when you said communication, laughing.
Oh, you got to laugh.
And the ability to pray and pull together and have good leadership. When you said that the POWs as a group had a lower percentage of people that experienced post-traumatic stress than the general troops in general. And that must have been because of the communication, the leadership, the taking care of one another.
You got to understand that's all driven by values. We walked into Hanoi with a common set of values. And for us, helping one another was the right thing to do. We did so instinctively without forethought. In other words, our value system was on automatic pilot. You don't arrive in great tribulation and then make up your value system. The die is cast when you arrive. And I can give you an example of that. When you were captured, you were taken to the torture chambers and you were put in isolation. You were put in an isolated cell. Then they would come and take you to the torture chamber. And they would ask you a question like, what's your squadron? Give me all the names of the people in your squadron. You had no idea, because you were totally isolated, what everybody else had done. You didn't know, for example, well, let's see, half of them said it's okay to do that, half of them didn't. You knew nothing. So you were in command. You had your own command, your own decision. One by one, everybody there went into torture, not knowing what the others did. That's called a value system held in common. And values cannot be contained by concrete and steel.
And in a situation like that, when you're stripped down, broken down, tortured,
whatever your values are, they come out. That's right.
And it floats to the top.
You can get out, and remember, in a POW camp, you can be out-leveraged physically. You can't bring your intellect to bear. They don't give you a chance to do it. The only thing you got left to fight with is your heart, your spirit, driven by what you value about life, about living, and about being.
And, sir, you weren't really surprised that you had a lower experience ratio of PTSD than the general troops.
Yeah, I was, when I first became aware of post-traumatic stress disorder, particularly once I discovered that the returning veterans had a 30% incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, I began to reflect on, well, how much did we have? And I couldn't think of any. One of the things that we do as POWs, The Navy in Pensacola, Florida, has a repository to maintain data on all POWs for all wars. And they have an extensive data set for Vietnam prisoners of war. And one of the things they ask us to do is to come down and take annual physicals so they can update their database. I was down there about a year or so ago, and one of the requirements is to see a psychiatrist as part of your physical. And so after the psychiatrist finished asking me if I like red or blue colors, I turned to him and said, I have a question for you. I said, I am asked all the time how much post-traumatic stress disorder returning Vietnam POWs had. And I said, as far as I know, they don't have any. I'm not aware of it, at least. I think I should be. And I said, you're the psychiatrist. What say ye? He gets up, goes to the file cabinet, pulls out a paper, hands it to me, the title of which was 37-Year Longitudinal Study on Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder for Returning American Vietnam POWs. And I thumbed through it, couldn't understand it, handed it back to him. I said, what does this thing say? He says, less than 5%. I said, and what's the vet's average? He says, 30. I said, okay, if you did your work correctly, it begs the question, why? I think the answer to that, to why that huge difference exists, is much more complex than I'm able to deal with. However, I did ask him what it was, and he said, we call it optimism. And then I jabbed at him by saying, are you sure that's a medical term? And he smiled. And I said, well, as far as I'm concerned, what we took in to that nightmare is why we were able to have such a low incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder. The values we took in common into that long night of terror.
And the opportunity to care for one another throughout that.
Which is a value.
Which is a strong value.
Yeah, which is a value.
Colonel, we've just got a couple more questions. It seems today that you're teamed up with an outfit called First Command.
And, I am indeed.
And they're giving you an opportunity to tell your story all over the country.
Yes, First Command stepped up to the plate. Our heritage is military service, devotion to family. We've been in business for in excess of 55 years. We're continuously looking for ways to make a difference in the lives of great Americans, including our military members and veterans.
Most of our listeners know I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I think it's a small world when I told you earlier I was there on May 15th, 1972, when we closed up Cam Ranh Bay, and
you were one of
the first to open it up.
Yep, we opened and closed it. The story, the American Vietnam Prisoner War experience, like I said, it's not a story about the plight of American POWs nearly so much as it is a revelation of the power of traditional American values, which all Americans share in common.
Colonel, one final question. We have a lot of listeners all over Minnesota, and a lot of our listeners have told us that their family, their next generations, are considering going into military service. What would you say to young people today if they were considering joining the Air Force or Army, any of the military services, about what you've learned in your lifetime and your experience as a POW in Vietnam?
You will be joining the ranks of great people, serving a mission of the and I can't think of a more noble mission. I recognize, along with a lot of folks, that the military today put under a lot of pressure that we did not experience. I mean, multiple deployments and things of that nature, budgets that are falling dramatically and so forth. And I would say to the young men and women that want to go into the military service, it is a great place to make a contribution not only to the country but to your own soul. Because life's all about acquiring stuff, but giving stuff. And I would also tell them that these current difficult circumstances that our military members are facing will not last. And they are able to overcome those difficulties. Things will get better. You can rest assured of it.
One thing certain in life, sir, that things do change.
Yes.
And the missions change, but today's United States military is still the strongest military in the world, and we've got a lot of great young men and women serving today, and I'm sure they'll carry on the tradition that our Vietnam veterans and the POWs have carried on.
And our young men and women that are coming into the service need to realize their relationship is not with the government. It's with the people. It's with their neighbors.
Just as when you go into battle and go into war, it's going in, accomplish your mission, and come back home with all your battle buddies.
That's the relationship. I would like to express my very humble and profound appreciation to all of those veterans, soldiers, sailors, Coast Guardmen, Marines, that were asked to do the impossible during the Vietnam War and came home to a hostile homecoming. So my hat's off to our veterans, our honored dead, and our missing in action, and to all of those who stand for liberty.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That was former POW and retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger. To close out this show, I'd like to share some thoughts about the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., which us Vietnam veterans refer to as the Wall. There are some interesting statistics about the war that a lot of people don't know. There are 58,267 names now listed on that polished black wall, including those added in 2010. The names are arranged in order in which they were taken from us by date, and within each date, the names are alphabetized. It's hard to believe that it's 59 years since the first casualty. The first known casualty was Richard Fitzgibbon of North Weymouth, Massachusetts, listed by the United States Department of Defense as having been killed on June 8, 1956. His name is listed on the wall with that of his son, Marine Corps Lance Corporal Richard B. Fitzgibbon, who was killed on September 7, 1965. There are three sets of fathers and sons on the wall. 39,996 on the wall were just 22 years of age or younger. 8,283 were just 19 years old. The largest age group, 33,103, were 18 years old. 12 soldiers on the wall were 17 years old. 5 soldiers on the wall were 16 years old. And 1 soldier, PFC Dan Bullock, was 15 years old. How do you suppose he got to Vietnam? 997 soldiers were killed on their first day in Vietnam, and sadly, 1,448 soldiers were killed on their last day in country. 31 sets of brothers on the wall, 31 sets of parents lost 2 of their sons. 54 soldiers attended Thomas Edison High School in Philadelphia. I wonder why so many from one school. 8 women are on the wall, nursing the wounded. 244 soldiers were awarded the Medal of Honor during the Vietnam War, 153 of them are on the wall. Beelzeville, Ohio, with a population of 475 souls, lost 6 of their sons. West Virginia had the highest casualty rate per capita in the nation. There are 711 West Virginians on the wall. The most casualty deaths on a single day was on January 31, 1968, when we lost 245 soldiers. The most casualty deaths for the single month was May 1968, when we lost 2,415 casualties. For most Americans who hear this, they will only hear the numbers that the Vietnam War created. To those of us who survived the war, and to the families of those who did not, we see the faces. We feel the pain that these numbers created. We are, until we pass away, haunted with these numbers because they were our friends, fathers, husbands, wives, sons, and daughters. There are no noble wars, just noble warriors. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank former POW and retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Barry Bridger for sharing his story with us. And I'd like to thank Commissioner Larry Shelato, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us every weekend on this station for more stories of our heroes who sacrifice and serve our nation. And, of course, join us online at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week and every week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.